there! You are listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming at KMUZ.org. This is where Marion and Polk Soil and Water Conservation Districts and OSU Small Farms Program shine a light on partnerships and programs that conserve our beautiful natural resources in the Willamette Valley. We're illuminating our collective mission of conserving soil, water, and natural resources for urban and agricultural audiences in the Willamette Valley.
I'm your host, Delaney Herb, Program Assistant with the Marion Soil and Water Conservation District. On today's episode, we're talking with Adoni Melathopoulos, an assistant professor of pollinator health extension in the Department of Horticulture at Oregon State University. He has over 15 years of experience working together with commercial beekeepers and land managers to develop solutions for keeping bees healthy. Since 2016, he's been leading OSU's efforts to design, implement, and evaluate a statewide pollinator health program. He is on the coordinating team of the Statewide Bee Protection Initiative, the Oregon Bee Project, coordinates the Oregon Bee Atlas, and is the host of a weekly podcast about pollinator health, Pollination. Today, we will be discussing the Oregon Bee Atlas and what you, as the listener, can do to support native pollinators. So, have you ever wondered what draws the attention of passing pollinators, or how many different species you could be attracting? Well, that's exactly what we're going to help you with on this week's show. So without further ado, good morning, Adoni.
Good morning. It's a lovely day in the valley after all that fog.
If you could just do a little introduction, where you work and how you got into pollinators.
Yeah, I'm on the fourth floor of the Ag Life Science building. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture, and I'm Oregon's pollinator health extension specialist. And if you rewind the tape, the way that I got here, many of your listeners probably remember in 2013, there was a string of bumblebee poisoning incidences that took place. The first one was in Wilsonville, really public. And so the legislature came together and they struck a pollinator health task force. And out of that, it was everybody could agree, Oregon needed more educational resources around pollinators to help protect them, both from pesticides, but also in terms of creating habitat. So that's what I spend most of my days doing. And it's the best job on the planet. I love this job.
That's exciting. Awesome. So I've heard a little bit about the Oregon Bee Project. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, when you look at the legislation, what they wanted to do, they wanted OSU Extension, known for good outreach and engagement material working with state agencies. So if you look at the original legislation, it said consult with Oregon Department of Agriculture. And what we decided to do is have a bit more of a structured relationship. So the state agencies get together and we talk extension in the state agencies, but also quickly became aware that when it comes to things like habitat, soil and water conservation districts, you guys do the bulk of the work. And so having a kind of framework where different organizations can come together and strategize around state initiatives and regional and municipal initiatives around protecting pollinators, that's the Oregon Bee Project. It's a framework for everybody to get together and sort of make sure we have a good division of labor between statewide efforts, state agency efforts, regional efforts like soil and water conservation districts, and people, nonprofits that are working on the ground.
And what role does the Oregon Bee Atlas play with the Oregon Bee Project?
I have to say it's my favorite part. I've been educated in apiculture. I've worked with honeybees for a very long time. But when we were putting the Oregon Bee Project together, we had a very good way of measuring how honeybee colonies were doing. They're captured in national statistics. OSU does its own surveys. We even have a survey for beekeepers in urban areas. So we knew what was going on with them. We could track, if our program, educational programming was successful, we'd expect bee colonies to have fewer of these kind of episodic losses and the colonies would be doing better. But when it came to native bees, we were struggling with thinking about how to track them, how to figure out whether they're doing well or not. And it became quickly apparent that nobody really even had a checklist, you know, with birds. You know, there's 528 bird species in the state or something like that. But we didn't know how many bees were here. We didn't know their range maps. And, you know, I was always inspired when I would pick up a volume of Oregon Flora. You can open the guide up, our wonderful initiative to document the plants of the state. And you get a plant. You see dots where specimens have been collected. You have a range map. You have some natural history notes. I thought, gee, our first step to being able to figure out whether the education programmings are having a positive effect on pollinators is getting at least a list of who's here and see if somebody disappears or if bees that we haven't seen for years come back. That might be an indication that the educational efforts are having an impact.
That's great. And I know you mentioned pollinators and honeybees and native bees. So I know when someone says pollinator, I instinctively think honeybee. What is really the difference between a honeybee and a native bee? And what are other pollinators?
It's a great question. I guess the thing I would say is there are a lot of creatures, vertebrates and invertebrates, that feed on nectar and pollen on flowers. And ostensibly, they're pollinators. And I guess the term is loosely connected with flower visitors. Think of a hummingbird. Hummingbird is going in and it's collecting, it's collecting nectar. It's not collecting pollen. If it's transferring pollen, it's incidental. It's really looking for nectar. It gets its protein from eating insects. And so there are all these insects and vertebrates that depend on flowers for nectar, and some on pollen. And they may not be really effectively increasing seed set in that plant. So there's a lot of, you can think of what is called a pollinator as being a kind of herbivore, a very specific herbivore that's taking resources out of the plant. So some insects may not be very good pollinators, but they visit the flower. Bees are very good pollinators because they're the taxa that collects pollen exclusively as a source of protein. So they really rummage through a flower trying to gather the pollen so that they can cart it back to their nests to feed their young. So they often, in terms of pollen transfer in a broad genera of plants that we have in the state, they're the best. And when it comes to crop plants, by and large, honeybees do the bulk of the work. So commercial honeybee colonies, we have about 80,000 bees in the state. They're doing most of the pollination of like our berries, our tree fruit, our seed crops. They're doing the bulk of that work.
Where are those honeybees native to?
Oh, those, our honeybees are native to Europe. So they've been here for a very long time, hundreds of years. They came over in the 1600s and they've, been here all that time. And right now, our honeybees, most of our commercial honeybees, we're recording this in February, are not even in Oregon. They've all gone down to California, where the largest pollination event on the planet takes place, where they pollinate California almonds. But they'll be back in the state in March, and then they kind of do this march. They'll start on the berry crops, tree fruits. They'll go over to Madras and do seed production, out to the coast to do cranberries. They're native to Europe, the ones that we have. They come from populations in the high areas of Italy, Austria, the steppes of Russia. And right now, our resident bees aren't even here. They're all in California.
So if all those honeybees are down in California, what do our native pollinators do this time of year?
Yeah, it's a great question. Most of our bees are in some form of diapause. So if you go like end of December, all our bees are in some form of being quiet. Honeybees are the only bee that you'll see on a warm day in December when, because they don't hibernate, they're active all year round. But all the rest of them are in some form of diapause. And right now on a nice day like this afternoon, probably not next week when it gets a little cooler, you'll see bumblebees start to fly. They're some of our first bees to come out. The bumblebees are mated and they're fully formed adults. Sometimes we'll run into the adults in a bark mulch pile and they will, as soon as they got enough heat, they're going to go out and try and find, right now, if you have some heather plants in your garden, you'll probably see bumblebees. going in there with their shoulders, trying to get some nectar to feed after a long winter of diapause.
So you mentioned bark mulch piles. Is this the kind of habitat that they'll, you know, hang out for the winter in?
Yeah, bumblebees. So we have a lot of ground nesting bees. I failed to mention this earlier, but we think we have around 600 species of bees, and 70% of them are somewhere in the ground right now deep. And they've got very good mouth parts that allow them to dig deep into the soil. Bumblebees aren't like that. Bumblebees have very kind of not very well-developed mandibles for digging. And so they're often in some kind of loose mulch. You would see them in the forest, probably under a leaf litter or something like that. They can't dig very deep. They need something loose to go in. So sometimes you'll see them in a mulch pile because that's just perfect texture for them to kind of dig into. But leaf litter is probably where a lot of them spend their winters, in the duff.
So leaving your leaves in the fall can be very beneficial to these guys?
Yeah, I think for a lot of insects, having leaf debris, you know, there's a lot of insects, butterflies will be in that leaf debris. And if you, you know, clearly in some cases, you just need to clean up your leaf debris. It's just an issue. But if you have a semi-wild area, you know, waiting until, you know, it warms up, you get consistently warm temperatures in April, and then kind of dealing with it would help some of those overwintering.
Great. That's a great fall, you know, through the winter remnants to leave. So where should people begin if they would like to attract more of these pollinators to their backyard?
Well, I would say a lot of people take up beekeeping, and I would say that's probably not the best place to start. Beekeeping requires a lot of skills. I think people, especially during the pandemic, took up bread making and all sorts of like hobbies, but beekeeping really does require going to a school, having a mentor. It's pretty complicated. And I see many people who want to save the bees. They get the honeybee colony. They're unable to maintain them. And then the bees die. So I would say the reason to get into beekeeping is because you really love and are passionate about honeybees and you really want to learn. There's a lot to learn in apiculture. It's a fascinating area. But if you're interested in helping bees, I would say the first thing to do is start, if you've got some land, a lot of people don't, is to start a garden of some sort with some plants that support bees. I don't know if small parcels of land, you know, how much they add up and contribute to the overall population of bees. But at the very least, you can educate yourself because you'll quickly, as soon as you plant these things, you'll start to see bee diversity. And I think when you start to appreciate and see it, you'll learn. There is no blueprint to creating a good pollinator garden. The best way to do it is to know your pollinating insects, plant some things, and just work in that way towards figuring out how to attract all of them. I guess the thing I failed to mention is there's no one plant to rule them all. There's different bees, butterflies have different plant, specialize on different plant genera. So if you only have lavender, you may only attract two bee species out of, well, maybe five bee species out of the possibly 50 or 60 that are in your area.
So what are a handful or a couple of plant species that would be a really great place to start?
I would say that if you want to keep it simple, the trick to bees, so wild bee diversity, is this. You need some kind of a leguminous plant, some kind of, you know, clovers in your yard or things like that. Look at like seeds. You wanted to get some seeds. I would say Lacey Phacelia or anything in the Phacelia family, which is the plant that people probably don't know that much about. But you can find it in your garden centers. We've got a lot of native species, and there's a species from California that's widely available. It attracts a broad range of bees, and it's a good cover crop. It grows quickly, and it'll block out weeds. The other thing is sunflowers. We have a whole bunch of bees at the later end of the season that will go to anything in that sunflower family, but also any of the composites. So coneflowers, rebeckia, we've got some beautiful, well, the native Rebeckia, black-eyed Susans, are a little funny looking because they don't have any petals, but I love them. They got these big, thick spikes on them. But even our exotic bred Rebeckia, great bee plant. Coreopsis, any of those plants that are in the composite family will attract the late summer bees. So that would say that that's a great way to start if you're doing seeds. But I would also just urge people to consider planting some shrubs. We have some great native shrubs that attract a lot of different bees. You can think of it, you know, coming up in a little while, we're going to have Oregon grape blooming. Great if you have mason bees in your backyard. It's a great flower to support mason bees. I also think there's some great exotic shrubs. Like lavender is a great water-wise plant. It really doesn't require a lot of moisture and it blooms for a very long time. Bumblebees will love it. Maybe not the broad range of bees will go to it, but it's a matter of having these different plants in place, thinking about their water requirements. I love heather, but it is a water hog. And so it may not be the best plant. You might want to go to lavender or Oregon grape or some of our native plants. I also just love, people don't appreciate it as much because it's not as showy. I do love snowberry. Snowberry looks great in the winter. Those little white berries give you some color, but those flowers, you'll notice they bloom later in the year. And for a lot of bees, and it's a great water-wise plant. It's a native plant, really well adapted.
What I'm hearing is you just definitely want to get some variety, timing of flowers, early to late, to really keep those bees coming back, different varieties throughout the whole season.
Absolutely. And I guess the thing I want to just emphasize is people miss, if you were have a general rule, you need some shrubs for the spring. So, Potentilla, Oregon grape, just have some spring shrubs are going to give you a lot of pollen and nectar for your bees. And then you'll need some things blooming through the year, penstemons, the phacelia I talked about. But the key thing is towards the end of the season, you need to have composites. Most of our bee species at that time of year are composite specialists. Goldenrod's another great one. So we've talked about coreopsis, talked about coneflowers, talked about just regular sunflowers, just packed full of bees. And the nice thing about a sunflower is you can watch the bees on the flower. It takes them a long time. So you can get some great photographs for Instagram because you can get right up close to a bee on a big sunflower head and take lots of great pictures. So just making sure that you have those composites at the end of the year, some good shrubs, and then having some stuff that bloom in the middle of the year, middle of the summer, like snowberry or some of our, annuals or perennial forbs.
Just as a reminder, folks, we're talking with Adoni Malathopoulos of Oregon State University, and you're listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio. Now that we've got a few of those pollinator-attracting plants, are there any plants you found that deter pollinators from coming into your yard?
No, I wouldn't say deter, but there's a lot of plants that are just not attractive to bees. And gardens have to be multifunctional and also landscape. So some people really just like having, tea roses. But for a lot of those plants, they've been the anthers have been actually bred into another round of petals. So there's actually no pollen left in the flowers, and you end up with this big, beautiful rose, but it's not that great for pollinators. So just, I think people just need to be aware of making those decisions. If you want a big, beautiful rose to go out and drink your coffee by, like I do, that's one thing, but don't be under the illusion that it's going to help your pollinators. And I would say another thing that I've run into is, there's all sorts of double petaled flowers, but also sunflowers. There are some pollenless sunflowers. When you cut the sunflower, some people don't want the pollen to sort of drop because sunflower has a lot of pollen. So if you don't want a sunflower variety that's going to drop pollen on your tablecloth. So be careful when you're having sunflowers outside that they are pollen. Lemon Queen is great. Lemon Queen has a lot of branches, a lot of flowers. Look for a sunflower that has pollen, but also branches out. So you get not just one big head, but you've just got tons of heads.
It's not just the mammoth sunflower. We want a variety in there.
Absolutely. And I always look for you go east of the Cascades, you see we have our native sunflower all along the roadsides. And I think, finding the native sunflower is even better, but we have some great composites. I would, Grindylia, Mattia, we've got some great composite kind of native sunflowers out there, our gumweeds or tarweeds. name sounds awful, but they're beautiful plants, and they, you know, you'll find a lot of different bee species on them.
Fantastic. And they really brighten up the yard.
Sure do. Bloom forever too.
And I know you talked about some water-wise plants. So when it gets really warm in the summer and we're nearing droughts, is there a way you can provide pollinators and bees with water?
Yeah, people wonder about that. I think for butterflies, water is important. For honeybees, water is important. They use water to thermoregulate the colony. But most bee species actually don't collect water. They're not water collectors. And so it's not as important. But I do think when you are planting your garden, there are some plants that are just phenomenal, you know, water-wise, well-adapted plants. And you really should think carefully, especially when buying a shrub that's going to be there for a while. You do not want to be putting lots of water in the middle of summer on these plants. Most of these native shrubs and plants need a little water to get established, and then they're good. And you can do both. You can have great pollinator plants and without having to dump tons of water on them.
Wonderful. What are a few of the resources you would recommend for people who'd like to take their property and implement some more pollinator and bee-friendly species? Where can folks go to get involved or find out more information?
Well, I think your soil and water conservation districts is the first stop. You guys have some great material. I know, the WaterWise guide that was East Multnomah. Great guide for water-wise gardening, but also incorporating pollinators. They also have a good guide to pollinators and plants. So go to your local soil and water conservation district. They've got lots of information. We also have a guide called Enhancing Urban Landscapes for Pollinating Insects. It's 41 pages long, has garden designs in it, lots of concepts. It tells you how to maybe lay things. It has some garden designs. And we do have little postcards that we'll be giving to our volunteers or at the Master Gardener Clinic to show you these garden designs. So I would pick that publication up. You can find it at the OSU Extension website. And, you know, Master Gardeners as well. Our Master Gardeners across the state are increasingly being trained in pollinator garden design. They can tell you about plants. They can tell you a bunch of things, but also you come home with a plant, a shrub, want to know what time of year to plant it, how big do you need to make the hole? Because a lot of these plants will last very long without a lot of water or resources if they're planted right and cared for right and put in the right place. Master Gardener volunteers, as well as your soil and water conservation districts, will do that. Last thing I'll say, I just went to the Benton Soil and Water Conservation District and got my plants. Go to the plant sales of your soil and water conservation district. Those plants are well adapted. They know the pollinator plants, and they're the best deal anywhere.
Yeah, those annual plant sales. Ours is, by the time this comes out, we'll have just wrapped up. But every year we do those native plant sales. And
you have to remember, though, folks, you need to order in advance. These plants are not, they don't grow on trees. They need to be planned in advance.
Yeah, they generally start January, February every year. So keep your eyes out for next year.
It's really great because, you know, the plants are really affordable and you can get plants that you can't find in the nursery. So if you're looking for some great pollinator native plants, you know, I got myself a nine bark. I got myself some grandelia. I had some ground cover, you know, the kinnikinick. There's ground cover kinnikinick and Oregon grape. So I just went there and I spent a scandalously small amount of money on them. And that's what you guys do. You guys are there to make sure that these plants get out into the landscape. So really, if you plan ahead, plan your garden, and then get your order in the Soil and Water Conservation District, you can do this and it won't cost you a lot of money.
Is there anything you want to touch on about pesticides and pollinators? Just briefly, I don't want to get too heavy into this one, but just any quick notes about safe pesticide use and how that relates to pollinators.
Yeah, just quick. I think most cases people don't need to use insecticides or fungicides on their plants. And when they do, it's because it's either a problem plant or there's an invasive pest. And so first thing before you're planting your garden, just get a sense of what the pest problems are and avoid those plants. That's the main thing. You don't even need to use them. Most of the native plants don't have any pest problems, and you stick to them, you're just not going to run into, like, you're never going to need to use anything. Herbicides are another matter. For a lot of, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of pollinator gardens where people have not done good weed control. There are alternatives, but sometimes using a herbicide smartly is a great way to make sure that everything is clean so that you don't have to use it for 50 years later. Like, you just get a nice clean bed, you put your mulch down, you grow things. So I think by and large, you can avoid them. And the biggest thing you can do is just talk to the master gardeners. Is this a plant that I'm going to be constantly, azaleas, azalea lace bug, they're all going to get infected. It's just, no, there's no way you can get around it. You're going to have to do something with it. Don't plant it. There's some great alternatives to azalea that can fill that role, that are native and water wise and are great for pollinators. If you choose that plant, you won't ever need to use anything.
Sounds like those master gardeners are a great resource and tool to reach out and use.
Goodness, they totally are.
So a few final little questions. I know on your podcast, Pollination, you always ask folks about their favorite pollinator.
Oh, yeah.
So who is your favorite pollinator?
I have my answer is I love honeybees. I learned bees through honeybees. And the thing I love most about honeybees is that there's a community of people associated with them. So right throughout Oregon, every county has them. They have these bee clubs. It's like a bowling league for beekeepers. And I just love the interaction. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you guys have one. There's one up in Salem. And, you know, there are great opportunities to meet people who have similar interests and get together. And I love people more than I love bees. So the honeybee is the people's bee.
That's great. And then a couple of themed questions for Conservation Spotlight. What is your favorite Oregon critter? And what is your favorite outdoor space?
Oh, great. I really love the small fairy bees in the genus Perdida. And that connects to space. You know, we have this program in called the Master Melittologist. We train people how to survey for bees across the state. And we have a regular camp event at Cottonwood Canyon over on the east side of the state. And, you know, the east side of the state erupts with bees suddenly when the rabbit brush comes into bloom. And you'll find these tiny little, they look like little flecks. They're so small, and they're our smallest bee species, and they're great. But if I can have two, because you guys are west of the, I really love Columbia, the Greenbelt Land Trust property. They have the really nice one just outside of Salem. The popcorn flower comes in the bloom, and there's just so many great bees there, but there's great Greenbelt Land Trust properties in Corvallis. Check them out. They've done some great restoration work on their properties.
Wonderful. And do you have any final thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, I'm looking forward to spring like all of you, and just, you know, keep an eye out for your pollinators. There's a rich diversity of bees out there, and they can provide you with hours of entertainment, as they filled my whole life and career up with just giggles and laughs and aha moments. So go out and explore your bees.
Do you ever pet the bumblebees? The big bumbles.
Oh yeah, all the time. Oh yeah, we, you know, one of the things we do, and I hope we have outdoor events, is we often do the bee petting zoo, where, you know, we'll go come up to an event, we'll catch some bees, we'll cool them down, and then for a few minutes, you know, you can put them on a person's hand and they can watch them close up until they get enough heat, and then they fly off and do their business. It's a great way to engage people, because you can see them up close. You know, they're always zipping around. You never see how amazing. A lot of them have their face have these markings. They've got funny looking legs, and they never see this. So yeah, petting zoo, bee petting zoo is like a big thing for us.
I've been talking with Adoni about native Oregon pollinators and how you can get involved. I'm your host, Delaney Herb, program assistant with Marion Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you for taking a few minutes to share the light with us. We are grateful for a community of conservation-minded folks who know the importance of partnership. If you would like more information on this topic, please visit our website, marionswcd.net, and our Facebook page for follow-up information. You can also visit the Oregon Bee Atlas website, through OSU Extension for more information. Our next virtual event is First Friday, an hour-long presentation the first Friday of every month discussing a new topic. Join us April 1st as we host Jenny Mizell to discuss invasive species ID. And if you like what you heard here on the Conservation Spotlight, tune in next month to KMUZ at 100.7 or 88.5 FM, the third Wednesdays during Willamette Wake Up. Thanks for listening. Keep your light shining.